This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling.
America is built on hard work and powered by American energy. Chevron has spent $44 billion with local businesses across all 50 states since 2022, fueling infrastructure and communities, all while strengthening local economies. Last year, Chevron increased U.S. production nearly 20%, powering communities and businesses from the heartlands to the coast. We're helping to fuel America's energy advantage, building a brighter future right here at home. Visit chevron.com/America to discover more.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. Now, I was looking for fun ways to tell you that Mint's offer of unlimited premium wireless for $15 a month is back. So I thought it would be fun if we made $15 bills, but it turns out that's very illegal. So there goes my big idea for the commercial. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. New customer offer for first 3 months only. Speed slow after 35 gigabytes if network's busy. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Our Nation. I'm Brian Kilmeade. We are live tonight, and coming up on the show, you're going to love this lineup. We got Senator Mark Wayne Mullen. I made sure his night ended a little bit later, the latest on the gerrymandering madness. We also have Governor Mike Huckabee, who's now Ambassador Mike Huckabee, the latest on the war zone in Gaza and the reaction of the Israeli people as well as the rest of the world and the reality on Gaza and what it's really like there. And George Allen, the former senator, former governor, here to talk about his dad and the deal that he worked out with the Redskin Nation, with the actual Native Americans, to put that helmet, the chief on their helmet all those years ago. The real story and why Donald Trump is right on the money to fight to get that Redskin name back. But first, Arctic power talks. President Donald Trump is meeting with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, Friday in Alaska. This is the first face-to-face between the two since 2019 and the first U.S.-hosted summit with Russia since 1988. The last time Vladimir Putin was on American soil was 2015, attended the U.N. General Assembly in New York City.
Well, first of all, I've got to give the president a huge amount of credit here, Maria, because this is a major breakthrough for American diplomacy. If you go back, this war has been going on for over 3 years at this point, well over a million Russians and Ukrainian dead soldiers. And as the president says, the numbers are probably much higher than the official tally indicates. There has been no substantial breakthrough. And for 6 months,
So now we'll try for a home run on Friday. The goal, end the war. But Ukraine's President Zelensky is not invited as of yet. Trump is open to a three-way meeting. But right now, he's planning bilateral talks with Vladimir Putin one-on-one. Now, Putin's demanding more territory in eastern Ukraine. Trump admitting negotiations will not be easy.
It's very complicated, but we're going to get some back. We're going to get some switched. There'll be some swapping of territories to the betterment of both.
Yep. Russia controls about 20% of Ukraine. They just took, they stole it. Ukraine holds just 30 square miles of Russia after they punched into Kursk about last year. Zelensky vows not an inch will be ceded, but he's got to go to his parliament. The world will be watching. Joining us now to expand on what could take place, the former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and CIA director under Trump 1. Mr. Secretary, what do you think happens on Friday?
Well, Brian, I'm most interested in actually what happens these next 4 or 5 days. It will be absolutely fascinating to see as President Trump continues to apply pressure against Vladimir Putin. He has already achieved something. President Biden was completely irrelevant. Putin was rolling. He lost deterrence, and Putin took a significant piece of Ukraine, which he didn't do under President Trump. And so these next days in the lead up to the meeting, I think you'll see lots of activity. I think you'll see lots of blustering from both sides, from the Ukrainians and the Russians. But President Trump has the chance to sit face-to-face with Vladimir Putin and make clear, this is over. You've got to end this. The terms aren't going to be exactly the ones you want. We need a ceasefire, and then we can resolve all the hard problems that remain in front of us. But you cannot continue to do what you've been doing, killing innocent civilians and taking over 20,000 Ukrainian kids.
That's an unbelievable stat that really gets the president's attention. By the way, Gallup did a poll of the Ukrainian people. In 2022, they asked him, what would you like a settlement to be like? They said they favored Ukraine fighting until victory. 73% wanted that. Now, 69% say they favor a negotiated end to the war because they've been taking a lot, as well as they've been fighting, they've been taking a lot of abuse from the Russians. Just now with their with the drones, they're doing real damage to civilian locations. I want you to hear what Senator Lindsey Graham said about how this could end up.
Ukraine's not going to evict every Russian, and Russia's not going to Kyiv. So there'll be some land swaps at the end. But what would a good deal look like? Make sure that 2022 doesn't happen again. On Biden's watch and Obama's watch, Russia invades. The goal for me, and I think President Trump, is to end it forever.
Right. So to end it forever, what does that look like, Mr. Secretary?
Yes, I think Senator Graham has that largely right. As I wrote about this months ago, we're not going to get all of this land back to Ukraine immediately. This is a long-term proposition. So you have to get the ceasefire. You have to stop the killing. You talked about the polling inside of Ukraine. I'll bet if you polled the Russian moms who'd lost their kids, they'd be damn tired of this too, Brian. And so I hope we can find the method that President Trump can restore the deterrence. We can put a security architecture in place, Europeans leading, Europeans funding it, a security architecture in place that gives us, I don't know if it's forever, but 25 more years where Vladimir Putin or the next Russian leader doesn't take another chunk of Europe. This is what President Trump is really good at. I'm confident he'll make a step towards that on Friday. And I'm very, very hopeful we can deliver an outcome that is really good, not just for Ukraine, but I remind you all the time, this is really good for America. If Europe is seen to have ceded ground to Russian aggression, woe be unto America. It will be a very difficult time. And Xi Jinping in China is watching this as well.
Do you also believe that the 100% tariff or whatever it is on India, who's buying cheap Russian oil to fund that war machine, does that been communicated from Modi to Putin? Hey, Vladimir, end this thing. It's going to cost us money.
Yeah, this is going to be very expensive for the Indians. I hope President Trump will begin to enforce that immediately. Friday, August 8th was the day. I hope he'll start to enforce that, not just against the Indians, against everyone who's buying this cheap, discounted Russian oil. So I know it's complicated with the Chinese Communist Party, but they are a real adversary, and we ought to impose these sanctions against them, against the Brazilians, against everyone who is using this sanctions regime to their benefit. We can't let them get away with this. We have to put pressure on the Russian economy. We know how to do this. We did it against the Iranians in Trump 1. President Trump can do it against the Russians now and put real pressure on Putin to get the ceasefire that President Trump wants and a good outcome for the United States of America.
And what you always tell me is try to put yourself in the other person's shoes. So Vladimir Putin, got it. KGB, understand it. But it's not to his advantage to alienate Trump for the next 3.5 years. If he decides to come with nothing but accept his 5 ridiculous demands, which we all know about, it'll make Trump look bad. And then again, you'll be sit there marginalized from the Western world for the next 3.5 years, and who knows who's the next president is. I want to bring up something else that used to be, and that is CIA director. Now, all of a sudden, we got this story about what the with Brennan and Comey and Obama and Biden were up to back in 2016. We found it annexed on the Durham report that was very revelatory about what was really taking place back then. Here's Tulsi Gabbard.
Over 100 documents that we released on Friday really detail and provide evidence of how this treasonous conspiracy was directed by President Obama just weeks before he was due to leave office, after President Trump had already gotten elected. This is not a Democrat or Republican issue. This is an issue that is so serious it should concern every single American because it has to do with the integrity of our democratic republic.
Have any idea that your predecessor, along with James Comey, the FBI director, were up to the antics that it's been revealed over the last few months?
Oh, of course. Look, there have been a few new documents, but conceptually, there's nothing new here. Folks have been writing about this, including me in my book, talking about how this was a Hillary Clinton dossier, Hillary Clinton political effort, that the intelligence community was treated poorly, mostly by Comey and Brennan, the senior political operatives, that there were people in the agency that I ran, that I spoke to when I was the director, who communicated clearly to me that they had had pressure put on them in those weeks between the election and President President Trump taking office to put out this thing that became known as the ICA, which included a dossier which the intelligence professionals knew was not up to intelligence standards. And so I think it is absolutely the case that there was a political hit job inside the intelligence committee led by both Comey and Brennan. And I leave it to this administration to decide what to do about how to hold those leaders accountable.
Would it bother you if they got away with it?
You know, the fact that we're calling them out, we're talking about it here, seems important to me for the American people. Yeah, it would bother me. Anytime somebody politicizes intelligence and there is not a cost to be paid, there's no accountability associated with it, it bothers me greatly.
Mr. Secretary, always great to catch up with you. Thanks so much. Truly appreciate it.
Thank you, Brian.
You got it. Talk to you soon.
Have a good evening, sir.
Now this.
I'm authorized to call a special session every 30 days. It lasts 30 days. And as soon as this one is over, I'm going to call another one, then another one, then another one, then another one. If they show back up in the state of Texas, they will be arrested and taken to the Capitol. Now, if they want to evade that arrest, they're going to have to stay outside of the state of Texas for literally years.
I'm not going to let our democracy be eroded away because there's a blatant power grab to maintain power in our nation's capital. This is what I call a legal insurrection.
Sounds like it, right? Is gerrymandering madness taking over this country because the midterm elections are upon us? The Texas House will attempt to establish a quorum tomorrow after Democrats continue to dodge responsibility and hide out maybe somewhere in the state or over in Illinois, maybe go to California. Looming threats of arrest, fines, and declaring their seats vacant. I'm not sure. They're not getting paid. What's going to push them back into Texas? And now California and New York, as you just heard, getting involved. Gavin Newsom inviting those Texas Democrats to proceed right to his state. But Texas isn't standing for it, already filing a legal complaint in California to enforce those arrest warrants. You just heard Governor Abbott talking about it. Joining me now for more on this standoff is Senator Mark Wayne Mullen. You've been watching this from the outside in Oklahoma since you left. Senator, what do you think is going to happen in Texas?
Well, these representatives are going to eventually have to come back home. I mean, that's where they live, and that's also where their paycheck comes from. But it's interesting to me, Brian, because you look at Illinois. Illinois is the worst gerrymandering district literally in the country. If you look at District 17 and District 13 in Illinois, it looks like snakes that are running through there. And then the second worst gerrymandered state is California. California has, believe it or not, 40% of their residents are registered Republicans, 60% Democrat, but yet they have 52 seats and only 9 seats are Republican. Now, how do you do that? You do it by gerrymandering. And it's interesting that both those governors are inviting Texas Democrat state reps to come to their state. It's like, I wonder if they know what they're talking about. Yes, they know what they're talking about. Their states need to be looked at. Lawsuits need to be filed in Illinois and in California and make them redo their seats as well.
Kristen Welker actually pushed Governor Pritzker on this. He had absolutely no answer except for, in some subtle way, saying, please make me president. I want you to hear what Karl Rove said. No one knows Texas better than Karl Rove. Watch.
Both parties do it. And this is one of the fun things for me is that take a look at this. Think about it. They went to Illinois. Trump got 40% of the vote in Illinois, and 82% of the members of the delegation are Democrats. New York, 43% for Trump, 73% of her are Democrats. Then California, 38%, and 83% of the delegation are Democrats. And what about Texas? In Texas, Donald Trump got 56% of the vote. And the Republicans are 66% of the total. Now, what will happen is if the new plan is adopted, then 79% of the delegation will be Republican. That's assuming that the Republicans defeat a popular, albeit troubled, Democrat incumbent in South Texas who ran 6 points ahead of Kamala Harris.
You think Florida is going to be next? I mean, when Texas comes home, whatever happens, Florida says they're going to maximize things. New York, as you just heard, they're going to try to get more seats. California is going to try to get more seats. How does this play out over the next year?
Well, ever since the court case was ruled that you can't really draw maps based on race, but it's supposed to be strictly based on barriers and population, I think a lot of these maps are going to be redrawn. And guess what? This is going to be horrific for the Democrat Party because they have been gerrymandering their states to be able to make it even competitive. I mean, just look at our state population to begin with, and you start looking at the land mass that goes red versus goes blue. why they're fighting so hard, why Illinois and Texas or in California are fighting so hard against Texas, is because they know their state could possibly be redrawn, and of course they would lose seats. By the way, if you redraw red states, they're also going to pick up seats for Republicans. They're going to lose Democrat seats because they've been holding on to this court by race-based drawing districts, and that's no longer acceptable according to the courts. So this is actually great news for Republicans. It's horrible for Democrats.
I want to bring you to another fight. I know you're a guy that doesn't mind fighting. Trump versus Mamdani. This Democratic primary guy who won the Democratic primary and has 50% of the vote in almost every poll, leading by about 20 points, says he's going to be Donald Trump's worst nightmare. I want you to hear from Mamdani. Listen to this.
My administration would be Donald Trump's worst nightmare. And you don't need to take me at my word or take Andrew Cuomo at his. You need only look at the actions of the Trump administration since I won the Democratic primary.
Is he going to be a nightmare for the president?
No, not a chance. Maybe you should pay attention to what the president has to deal with on the daily basis from the biased media. What is going to be a nightmare is for New York's economy. You're going to have companies fleeing the city of New York in droves. Can you imagine if you're right now and you're a capitalist and you're growing your company and you're looking at a state to go to, you're looking at a city to go to, are you paying attention to New York? No. And if you're a business guy right now in New York, are you looking to exit New York City? Absolutely you are. So the only thing he's going to be a nightmare on is New York City's budget.
Yeah, they also need a lot of funding for a lot of their programs, including Medicaid, from the federal government. And I believe the purse strings are at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. He'll learn that, but he knows very little because he has very little experience. Lastly, we keep hearing about... go ahead. You want to comment before we move on?
No, I was just going to say, Brian, he has zero experience. He hasn't even won a general election yet. The guy hasn't even been elected yet. And I'm not saying he's going to be. In fact, I in a way, I kind of hope he gets elected just so people can see what this socialist communist does to a big city like that. But in another way, I don't want to see the city fail either. Right. But the guy has no room to talk. After he wins election, maybe he can run his mouth a little bit.
All right. Finally, can you explain to me what the nuclear option might be for the Senate? They are now holding up 144 of Donald Trump's nominees. I don't know if they object to any of them. They're just trying to make, I guess, Donald Trump pay a price for being Donald Trump and the Republicans for not being Democrats. What would a nuclear option look like? Because I always thought a nuclear option was a majority, and all you do need is a majority to get anybody nominated.
Well, actually, the nuclear option has already happened, Brian. What's happened with the nuclear option is exactly what the Democrats have done underneath Chuck Schumer by filibustering literally every one of President's nominees that we have nominated, with the exception of Marco Rubio. So out of 163 we've got nominated, or we've got confirmed, Chuck Schumer's literally... he's filibustered 162 of them. So, and that's never happened before. This has never happened in any president in the history of the United States. In fact, underneath George H. Bush, the nominations, 98% of his nominees went by voice vote or by unanimous consent. So the nuclear option has already happened. What's happening now is the Republicans are going to have to respond to that. And what we're going to probably do, we got a couple of options. One, we can eliminate the debate time from 2 hours down to 15 minutes or 10 minutes, or eliminate debate all the time altogether. Also, right now we have to go on every single nominee. We got to go in and out of legislative session into executive session. So it takes 4 votes per nominee, which is about a 4-hour time frame to get one nominee done. We can eliminate that and say we're just going to stay in executive session the whole time. And because Harry Reid actually went nuclear and went from 60 to 51 to change rules, we're just going to follow Harry Reid's path that he put on us. And we're going to have to change the rules so we can get President Trump's nominees in place. So we have several options. What we know we're going to have to do is we know we're going to have to do it because Chuck Schumer has made this decision himself. And so we're going to get President Trump's nominees confirmed, and we're going to do that in a fast pace, and we're going to change the rules probably, I would say, within the first week we get back.
Yeah, every department is running lean because these guys, the undersecretaries, the deputies, Mike Waltz, UN ambassador, got out of committee and is just waiting.
Right.
No one has objections to almost everybody.
Right.
Senator Mark Wayne Mullen, thanks for mirroring the lack of tie tonight. I love the way you match the show. And thanks for leaving your family and walking into a van for us. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Appreciate it, Brian.
All right, go get him. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Netanyahu wants full control of Gaza. The latest with Ambassador Mike Huckabee next from Jerusalem. And still to come, waging war against the woke. Donald Trump wants to bring the NFL Redskins name back. The son of the former Redskins head coach, George Allen, former governor and senator, will tell us the real story of how that chief emblem went on the helmet because his dad was there. And please catch me on tour with Fox Nation. History, Liberty, and Laughs. I'll be on stage in 2 weeks, August 23rd at the Winspear Theater. It's going to be great. BrianKilmeade.com. Also September 27th in Richmond, Virginia. Hope to see you there in person. Bring up the music. I woke up on the wrong side of the truck bed this morning with a bone drop. I
love Jackass Party. Damn, she got some nerve where she... Total Beats Ultimate Heart Health is the...
Welcome back. Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is defending Israel's plan to seize all of Gaza. Despite international outrage, UN officials warned it risked unleashing, quote, another calamity on a territory already experiencing starvation.
Our goal is not to occupy Gaza. Our goal is to free Gaza, free it from Hamas terrorists. The war can end tomorrow if Gaza, or rather if Hamas, lays down its arms and releases all the remaining hostages.
Well, there are still 50 hostages remaining in Hamas captivity, 20 of which are believed to be alive. Joining us now, the U.S. ambassador to Israel, former Arkansas governor and Fox News employee, Governor Mike Huckabee, who is now Ambassador Mike Huckabee. Ambassador, you got back from Gaza a short time ago. You really are literally in the eye of the storm. I saw all those protesters not wanting, I guess, in Israel, looking to not finish off the job in Gaza. Where do you stand? What's the right next move for the IDF and the Israeli people?
Well, the next move really is one that Hamas has to make. They're either going to have to walk away, disarm, and let the hostages go, or they're going to have to face the consequences of an Israeli government that is just fed up with 22 months of seeing their hostages starved, mistreated, brutalized, tortured, and in many cases murdered. The Arab League has it right, Brian. They're the ones, interestingly, who unanimously said Hamas needs to disarm and let all the hostages go at once. That compared to the Europeans who are out there saying, no, it's Israel that has to make the move. It's Israel that has to be responsible for feeding people. And I'm just asking, when in the history of the world has a nation that has been attacked, been expected to feed the enemy in the midst of a hot war? I've never heard of it ever in history, and nobody can point me to it.
And how about the Hail Mary that Qatar and Egypt evidently putting together to try to get Hamas to leave and give up the hostages?
We would all be thrilled if that would happen. And for 22 months, there had been every attempt. People don't have any idea how many different ways the Israelis have compromised to put things on the table that could have ended this. Some things they didn't really want to do, but they were willing to do to get the hostages home. Every time Hamas says they're coming to the table, says they're open to it, and then they arrive and say, no, there's some other things we've got to have. And what they have to have always are unreasonable. And the result has been a stalemate. So if something can happen out of the negotiations, of course everyone would be thrilled. But it hasn't happened yet, and Israel can't just let those hostages, there are 20 that we think are still alive of the total 50, languish forever and ever. We saw the pictures of how emaciated they are and how Hamas is even forcing the hostages to dig their own graves while in captivity.
So the other topic that I think you're familiar with, it was happening in Colombia. This Mahmoud Khalil was about to be deported. He still might be, but now he's speaking. And he talked about his attempt. He thought October 7th was an attempt to justify. He's trying to justify the attacks of October 7th. In his interview with Ezra Klein on The New York Times, here's what he said.
To me, it felt frightening that we had to reach this moment. And the Palestinian struggle. Unfortunately, we couldn't avoid such a moment. I knew, like, that's what Netanyahu wants, because Netanyahu thrives on the killing of Palestinians.
So he said October 7th couldn't have been avoided because their voice wasn't being heard, and he feared an agreement between Saudi Arabia and Israel was imminent. What's your reaction?
in the American justice system, you can have the right to remain silent. He should have done so. But again, when he spoke, what he basically said was that Hamas was justified in raping women in front of their children, yep, beheading babies, putting them in ovens, lighting grandmothers on fire as they sat in their wheelchair in the middle of their family, and brutalizing an entire group of people, murdering 1,200, taking hostage 250 and torturing them. And somehow that's all justified because they don't like the way that Israel is acting. Now, if that's not room for deportation, then there's no one that's ever going to be deported. This guy shouldn't be deported tomorrow or next week. It should happen within the next 15 hours or less. He ought to be on a plane, yeah, sent to someplace. I suggest let him go to Gaza. Let him live there. He seems to be thinking that they've done a wonderful thing by murdering Jews. So let him experience what the result of that is. This guy's sick and twisted, right, and the fact that he's still living in the United States under the banner of freedom is disgusting.
So there was a profile done on you by the New York Times, afterwards they actually published the whole, or put on audio, the whole interview. And you remarked, the CBS, I should say, and you remarked that, man, I wish people could hear the whole interview, what I said, as opposed to what was actually broadcast out. Here's a portion of that.
Increasingly strong language is being used about Israel's prosecution of this war, including from Israeli organizations. They've been accused of genocide.
If Israel is attempting genocide, they're really, really bad at it. They could have had genocide on October the 8th. If they were trying to commit genocide, it would not have taken them 22 months to do it.
How is it portrayed as opposed to what you said?
Well, on my Twitter account, I went ahead and put up the entire transcript of the interview. Thank goodness my staff recorded it, and therefore we have a full transcript of everything said, both by the reporter and me. So if people want to see how CBS twisted and edited that to make it sound like something very different than I said for the most part of the interview, we made it possible. It's a great reminder that for the most part, journalism in this world is dead, and there are very few people practicing it. What we wanted to do was expose the fact that they were taking a small portion of things I said, editing out the pushback when I was trying to tell this reporter things like that 87% of the food the UN is sending in is getting robbed, looted, stolen, and then sold on the black market to make Hamas money. She didn't want to cover that. She didn't want to cover the fact when I continued to press her on, if Great Britain and Ireland and Canada and France are so intent on pushing Israel, why aren't they pushing Hamas that hard when even the Arab League is? I just encourage people to read the whole transcript and then to see what they aired, and you'll see a very, very different juxtaposition of what was said and what they aired.
Ambassador Huckabee, we always like to come to you to get the answers directly, so there's no editing necessary, especially when we're live. Yeah. Ambassador, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Brian. Thank you.
You got it. Straight ahead. A Native American group, along with President Trump, want to bring back the name Redskins to the Washington Football Club. Is the name really a slur? The son of the former Redskins head coach, George Allen, who knows the real story of how that Indian chief picture got on the helmet, will join us next with the real story behind the Redskin logo. All right, we've been telling you for weeks the woke and political culture and the politically correct culture is done under President Trump. You've been seeing that. You've been watching it. He's gone to bat for high schools and small towns across the country, fighting to preserve their Indian heritage, Native American imagery. Just look at Massapequa, my town, where the community is taking on the state to keep the name Chiefs because no one's offended by it. But the biggest and most high-profile fight, the battle over the Washington Redskins name. Is the name really a slur? Was it something created by wealthy executives? Or is there something more to the story? It's time to get the real story with someone whose family lived it. Joining us now, well, his dad coached the team during the pivotal era we're talking about, when the Redskins shifted from the iconic yellow helmet that looked too much like the Packers to the classic burgundy and gold with the American Indian chief head on the helmet. So why did the team change the name, and why is President Trump now fighting to bring it back? Joining me now, the former governor and senator from Virginia, George Allen himself, whose dad was coach at the time, and also played in the WFL for a while. Senator, great to see you. What's the real story? How did that Indian chief head get on the helmet?
All right, let me get the context of all of this. My father was also general manager of the Redskins. But way before that, his first head coaching job was in Sioux City, Iowa, for Morningside College. And he took an interest in the history and American Indians generally, and especially one called Red Cloud, Chief Red Cloud. And he set up through the years, even when he was with the Bears in the mid-60s, the Red Cloud Athletic Fund to get sports equipment to the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. So he eventually gets to the Redskins. Vince Lombardi had switched the helmet to a gold helmet, as you said, or yellow helmet with the R on it, like the G in the Green Bay Packers. Chief Blackie Wetzel of the Blackfeet Tribe in Montana, who had been president of the National Congress of American Indians, came to my father, and he knew my father's interest and support for American Indians. And he said, "We don't like this R." And my father said, and this was 1972, my father's second year with the Redskins, and my father said to him, "Well, what would you like? To make a suggestion." So Chief Wetzel went back to the Blackfeet tribe and counseled with his tribe and other tribes, the Crow and others, in Montana, and came back with two suggestions. And one of them was this logo on the helmet right there. That is an actual Blackfeet Nation chief by the name of Two Guns White Calf. So when they have these folks putting like a no parking sign through that logo was recommended, designed, and advocated by American Indians, and not just American Indians, but you know, a leader of the National Congress of American Indians. And the reality is 90%, the Washington Post a few years ago did a poll on this, and they were all against the Redskins name, but 90% of American Indians support the name. They're not offended. And in fact, all of this, there's a book written by Mike Richman about my father, very meticulous book, and they devoted three pages just to this issue of the Redskins logo. Senator Daines of Montana is still trying to push for this. I know a chief here in Virginia, Chief Red Hawk of the Chiricahua tribe, and he says, you know, they're always trying to erase our Indian heritage and our culture. They had a paper genocide in some states of American Indians. And he says they look at it, 90%, at least in these polls, look at it as a tribute, not a disgrace demeaning.
So, Senator, do you want the president to hold off on stadium funding until they flip the name back?
Well, here's the thing. The president's on the popular side. And let me say this to the president and anybody watching. If they listen to these folks that say this name is derogatory, on the Navajo Nation lands, there's a high school called Red Mesa. The name of their team, the Redskins. Their logo is this Redskins logo. The only difference is they have a turquoise band around it. So if it's so demeaning and demoralizing and insulting, why do the Navajo, who are famous code talkers in World War II, why are they against it? So I think the president's on the right side of this. Now, he has jurisdiction because the new stadium is going to be on federal land, and they're kind of like sub-lessees.
Right.
So I think he's certainly on the popular side of it. And by the way, to the owners of the Redskins, as opposed to calling them, I call them the woke commodes, because WC everywhere means water closet. If they want to make a lot of money, if they brought this logo back and if they brought the name back, they would sell so much merchandise,
Governor,
and make tons of money.
I think the president's going to call you up to tell the real story in front of the cameras because you have great credibility. He knows of your dad. If he didn't meet him one-on-one, everybody who grew up during that era knows he was a dominant personality and the type of guy everybody wanted to play for. So that's why he produced such a great son. Senator and Governor, thanks so much for joining us with the real story. Meanwhile, next, the media moments that matter with Emily Austin, who's in studio. Don't move. That's the secret folder.
that matter.
All right, let's get right to it. It's our favorite segment of the week. This week, I gave the VCR, the TV guide, and all my cords and tapes to journalist Emily Austin. And Emily, do you now know what a VCR is?
I promise I only know what a VCR is because of you.
Thank you.
But so thanks
and
for the
TV
education.
Guide. She's a digital woman. But first off, I asked you to get three stories. First stop, Chuck Todd.
This is a week of reckoning. Ready? Chuck Todd worries Democratic Party hasn't lost enough to learn their lesson and change course. Listen.
I wonder if Democrats have lost enough to have the conversation they need to have.
No, they haven't.
Well, they convinced themselves that it was the referees, essentially. It was the referees' fault, right? It's a classic case of, right?
And the other big thing that's changed since Clinton's time was back then, Democrats had to hear from people who told them, you suck. Now they don't. Now they're able to walk around in their intellectual bubbles and tell each other we only lost by a little much, and it's the referee's fault.
Oh, if Kamala Harris just had 90 more days.
But if he was like that on Meet the Press, he'd still be hosting Meet the Press.
I know.
He was not even close to open to a Republican point of view or anything positive about Trump. But now that he's in the podcast world, he has a different approach.
It seems like they only realize when it's too late that they have to be centrist and that they're not tapping into 50% of the country. But when it's your own podcast and it's your own revenue, you start thinking smart.
So I remember Terry Moran was in the eye of the storm because he went after Stephen Miller on social media. He basically, they fired him the next day. He is now a freelance reporter, and he's talking openly about what it was like at ABC.
Another change of heart here. Ex-ABC News reporter Terry Moran admits the network's traditional media bias was against Trump. Who knew?
I had no idea. He went on to say, there were hardly any people who supported Trump at ABC News. And this is bound to impact coverage, not so much of the malevolent bias, but more out of the kind of deafness. The old news division don't hear many of the voices of the country because those voices aren't in the newsroom. So, yes, from my perspective, Terry Moran's perspective, the old news networks are biased. So he talked about prior to that saying they were so into broadening it out, having more voices, blacks, whites, more women of transgender, whatever. But they never thought, wait, I should get more Republicans in the newsroom. And in retrospect, they just had no perception of why anyone would vote for someone like Trump.
It's like they almost forget how elections work. The majority of the population vote for a certain person. Now, if you're seeing the majority of the country is voting for a Republican, maybe it's time to shift gears a bit and realize, hey, we're actually in the minority here. So for the sake of viewership, let's now appeal to them as well.
You know, what's interesting is if you're a Democrat, you almost have to be panicked more than any Republican over Mamdani winning the Democratic primary. And you see, no, Schumer's not saying anything. Hakeem Jeffries is not saying anything.
They're endorsing him.
Governor Hochul, they're not endorsing him.
Hochul endorsed him.
But no, she says we have too many differences, but we'll see what happens.
Change
of course. So, yeah, but what I'm trying to say is that they're panicking. And that's why, like, a guy like Rahm Emanuel says, I'm going to be a centrist. I'm going to go on with Megyn Kelly and maybe start broadening out the audience. Maybe that would make, an opportunity for someone moderate like a Joe Manchin to emerge.
I know Mamdani will unfortunately have to be New York's wake-up call. But speaking of wake-up calls,
yes,
let me bring you to topic number three. Stephen A. Smith, someone I love and adore, is having his wake-up call. He says the WNBA needs to embrace my beloved Caitlin Clark, or they could lose it all, suggesting federal investigations into the WNBA for their treatment of her. Stephen A. Smith.
Do not surprise that President Trump speaks on eventually. Be careful. Yeah. Embracing her is a long way towards that. Don't make her the enemy, because it's not going to work for the WNBA. Caitlin Clark, like it or not, is one of, if not the preeminent face in the WNBA. Get over it. Accept it. Rising tide lifts all boats. Ride that wave. There's something to get you to get from it, too. Get yours. Don't sit up there and hate on her to a point where you're going to make her the victim, and then other people going to go rally to her support against the WNBA. Caitlin Clark doesn't want that. The WNBA doesn't want that.
Emily, you're an NBA reporter. You have your own NBA show. Is he right?
Listen, Caitlin Clark is the Sydney Sweeney of the WNBA.
Yes.
She's beautiful. She's talented. She's a DEI hire.
So what's the problem?
She's the DEI hire. She's straight. She's white. She's talented. She's threatening what they're used to in a way. But like Stephen A. said, instead of embracing this talent, they're pushing her away. And if you ask me, I mean, I'm a woman. It's that woman jealousy. And you can't get rid of that, unfortunately.
So what is the future? Because right now, attendance is up 400%. Revenue is up through the roof because of her.
Solely because of her.
But to her credit, she doesn't complain. How about that?
She was snubbed for MVP. You're telling me, you are telling me there was any player better than Caitlin Clark. With all due respect to female athletes, she's the reason the WNBA is in conversation right now. I mean, Dave Portnoy said it. I'm going to second him on that. You just have to be very, either not self-aware, ignorant to deny that.
So in the 70s, when I was playing soccer, when Pele came to the Cosmos, they put 77,000 in Giant Stadium. And they wanted to take the ball from Pele, but they didn't want to kill him. Mm-hmm. They didn't hate him. When Beckham came to the LA Galaxy, 32 years old, great-looking guy, international star, they wanted to play well against him. They loved that he was in the league. I just don't understand why people can't just appreciate it.
We're gonna start a new trend. Caitlin Clark is the Sydney Sweeney of the WNBA.
I think you can coin that. Emily, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Please get back to VCR when you leave, along with the cords and the tapes.
You can have it.
You got it. Up next, your sneak peek of the week ahead. And don't forget, follow me on social media. I'm on Rumble, Instagram. I don't have the following gear as Emily, but X, Facebook, also Culper Club, exclusive content. Don't move.
Blue eyes and auburn hair, sitting looking pretty by the fire in a lawn chair.
All right, now it's time for your sneak peek of the week ahead. Tomorrow, the president's holding a press conference to address crime in Washington, D.C. The mayor might be there, might not. The Texas House will attempt to establish a quorum in the redistricting fight. See who came back from Illinois. Will be kind of exciting. Also, the Intel CEO, Louboutin, is expected to visit the White House after Trump called him out over his ties to Chinese businesses. And then Friday, the big meeting, President Trump and Vladimir Putin. It's going to be interesting over in Alaska. That is it for us tonight. Tune into my radio show from 9 to noon. Got Ambassador Gordon Sondland, Governor Chris Christie will be my guest, Brian Kilmeade Joe. Also, watch me in a few hours on Fox and Friends. Patty Morin, mother of Rachel Morin, will be with us to talk about how important it is to remember her daughter. Remember, stay within yourself, America. Keep it right here on Fox News.
Hey, I'm Trey Gowdy, host of the Trey Gowdy Podcast. I hope you will join me every Tuesday and Thursday as we navigate life together and hopefully find ourselves a little bit better on the other side.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com.